I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are growing calls for the man in charge of the United Nations to step down. Kofi Annan has been Secretary General of the UN for 8 years. He has another 2 years in office. But there are those who say that the latest report on the involvement of Kofi Annan's son in the UN's oil for food scandal is reason enough for Annan's early departure. Well, and others have their own lists of complaints. Sexual abuse by UN peacekeepers in Congo under Annan's watch, the ongoing rape and killing in Darfur, miscalculations of safety in Baghdad, and going back into Annan's time in peacekeeping, his role in the failure to prevent the killing of those in Rwanda and Bosnia, people who were then under UN care. Now, when Kofi Annan was asked if any or all of this had him thinking about stepping down, he answered with uncharacteristically undiplomatic language. "Hell no," he told reporters. So what do you think? Is it time for Kofi Annan to hand control of the UN to someone else? Are these questions about his judgment, or are these questions about the UN as a whole? And would the United Nations be a stronger and more effective organization with or without Kofi Annan? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me today, two guests who've been with us a number of times before here in the studio, is John Ruggie, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard's JFK School of Government and former Assistant Secretary General and Chief Advisor to Kofi Annan. John, it's nice to have you back with us.
Good to be here again.
And from a studio in New York, Andrew Thompson, currently Senior Medical Officer at the UN Medical Service in New York. Andrew has served with the UN in places like Haiti and Cambodia and Bosnia and Rwanda. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Dick.
I want to start with you, if I can, Andrew, because you've been very critical of the UN as a whole recently, and I'm wondering where Kofi Annan fits into this picture. Does he shoulder the blame for what's wrong with that organization?
You know, Kofi Annan's still my boss, so I owe him the respect that comes with that role. But at the UN, you have to think that the chief executive should be accountable for what goes on. And I can tell you that morale in the organization among the people I talk to is just at rock bottom at the moment with these unfolding scandals. As you said, oil for food, the sex for food scandal in Congo, senior UN staff accused of sexual abuse. So I don't know the answer to that. And I can see that it's a very polarized situation at the moment with people calling for his resignation, others defending him. I think it really depends on whether he can turn it around in his last 2 years.
And when you say morale is low at UN headquarters, Andrew, are you saying that people are feeling like they're being let down by the leadership, or just that this has become so much of a distraction that nobody's getting anything done?
I think it's a bit of both, Dick. I can say that one of the reasons that we wrote the book, which came out and led to my firing from the organization, is that we were demoralized in the field in places like Rwanda and Bosnia, Liberia and Somalia, seeing that there was such a difference between the ideals of the organization and what we were seeing on the ground. And we ran into the aftermath of two genocides, so perhaps, you know, if we'd done other missions, we may have been more positive. But it seems to be more of the same. It seems that there's such a difference between what we preach and the magnificent ideals for which we stand and what actually happens in the field. And that's demoralizing, particularly for the people who are risking their lives now on the front lines.
John Ruggie, you're not just a former Assistant Secretary General. You're a friend of Kofi Annan's. I know that you stay in touch with him even now, and I'm wondering if you have any insight into how he's making sense of all this.
Well, these have not been happy times for Kofi Annan. I saw him earlier this week. In fact, the day that the Volcker report came out, he obviously was relieved that the report cleared him of wrongdoing in the awarding of contracts. But he was deeply hurt by his son's uncooperative posture toward the commission inquiry. And by a number of other issues that were turned up in the report. I agree with Andrew that morale in the building is low. I think Andrew points to the gap between ideal and reality in some instances. And that's a problem for many institutions in society today, whether it's the U.S. Congress or whether it's the Catholic Church, and the UN is also implicated in that. I think another reason for low morale is that the staff as a whole feels that, in fact, the UN hasn't fought back effectively enough to some of the political exploitation of real problems by certain elements, particularly in American politics. And I certainly the people I talk to...
Be more specific for me when you say political exploitation of the UN.
Well, the Oil for Food program is a classic example. There certainly were management problems, oversight problems.
Corruption.
Looks like the man who ran the program was bribed by Saddam Hussein. Those are all real things. But those real problems were exploited shamelessly by certain Republicans on Capitol Hill. Distorted, I think is a better word, the magnitude of the problem by at least a factor of 10. What may have been a $2 billion problem became a $21 billion problem. Everything was attributed to Kofi. He was responsible for everything. The Security Council was responsible for nothing. And they didn't fight back effectively enough. And I think people in the place felt, we're a punching bag. We get beat up all the time by the outside, and we never fight back effectively, and someone's got to stand up for us. I think the morale problem stems from that as well.
What do you think, Andrew? Is it that Kofi Annan could have and should have, in fact, stood more toe-to-toe with his critics in Washington? Is that a part of this problem?
I'm not sure. I mean, I see a pattern repeating itself where if you look at Rwanda and the blame that was apportioned after that tragedy, where UN peacekeepers who were under Mr. Annan's management at the time abandoned a million people to their deaths in genocide, that there was a round of blame about that between the Secretariat and Mr. Annan and the Security Council and the member states and the troops on the ground. And somewhere I think the buck has to stop. Even if the Secretariat's only partially to blame for some of these scandals, I think they have to say it's partially our fault. Instead of pushing the blame onto other people, I think there's a knee-jerk reflex at the UN to shift blame, to blame others, at the same time as people being quite quick to take credit when things go well. And I think the member states play that game as well. But I think when you triangulate blame between the Security Council and the Secretariat and the member states, you end up with no one being responsible.
And you end up with an organization that I think everybody would agree is losing credibility. So back to John Ruggie here. Why wouldn't Kofi Annan say, you know what? Things aren't working under my watch. Maybe it's time for new blood. Is that something you've talked to him about? Is that something that you could imagine him doing?
At the moment, I think Kofi Annan is looking forward to the September summit to take up the reform measures that he put before the General Assembly a week ago, and he isn't inclined to go anywhere except to work with the member states to get that on track. The UN has 191 member states. So far, not one of them has called for his resignation. I can't imagine that he would resign unless he were pressured to by the member states themselves. Even the Bush administration has come out. They were, in fact, one of the first to come out after the Volcker Report to say that they look forward to continuing to work with him. Andrew put his finger on a really, really difficult problem in the UN. It's the nature of accountability in the organization is designed almost on purpose in such a way that, in fact, the buck doesn't stop anywhere. You take the case of Rwanda. In fact, Kofi Annan did accept some of the blame. I was involved in the Rwanda report at the time that he accepted fully. But events were unfolding in the field, our secretary, later Secretary of State, then UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright, was working overtime to make sure that no one in the Security Council used the word genocide, because that would impose a heavier moral burden on the United States, which did not want to get involved because it came so shortly after Somalia. Now, there was absolutely nothing that the Secretary General could do about that. It was an American policy decision that we will not get involved in Rwanda, therefore we will not countenance calling this a genocide.
Let me just go back to Andrew Thompson here. On the question of moral leadership, Andrew, what's missing? What's lacking?
I think that's basically what a Secretary General has. It's a moral position comes with prestige and credibility. So if you keep silent in the face of genocide, and I agree with John, it was the U.S. administration that refused to intervene in Rwanda. He's absolutely right there, and Kofi Annan has started to accept responsibility for that failure. But I think if all you have is moral authority, then you have to speak up. I think you have to scream from the rooftops when people are dying and the Security Council is not doing anything about it. And I think this applies to Darfur now. You wonder whether Mr. Annan might say on Darfur, well, the interests of the large member states in Sudan, which are blocking any movement there, are less important for me than the fact that almost 200,000 people have died, and really put his prestige on the line. I mean, the Secretariat asked young people like myself and others to go out and risk our lives on the front lines, and maybe the Secretary General could put his job on the line for something like Darfur. If you can't for genocide, I'm not sure when you can.
Connection listeners, what is the role of the Secretary General? Is it someone who really needs to take that public moral position, scream from the rooftops? Is it someone who needs to work with the member states? And what difference would it make if Kofi Annan stepped down or were asked to step aside as head of the United Nations? Would the organization be stronger or weaker as a result of that? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour. The question is simple. Is it time for Kofi Annan to step down as Secretary General of the United Nations? Is his own credibility as the leader of this organization so tainted by the Oil for Food scandal and his involvement in other matters going back 5-10 years that it is in fact time for new blood at the top? Andrew Thompson is with us. He's senior medical officer at the UN Medical Service in New York, and he's one of the people who has in fact screamed from the rooftops from within the UN. He and a couple of colleagues wrote a book called Emergency Sex and Other Desperate Measures, A True Story of Hell on Earth, detailing what they saw as the many flaws inside the organization. For that, Andrew lost his job. He was rehired last month and in fact promoted to his current position. He's with us to talk about how he sees the organization from within. John Ruggie is former Assistant Secretary General and Chief Advisor for Strategic Planning to Secretary Kofi Annan in the years 1997 to 2001. He's currently a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. John, I want to come back to you on the screaming from the rooftops idea, because I think it's key to figuring out what the role of that person at the top is. I hear what Andrew's saying. If somebody were to say, you know, stand up and really call the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans and the Sudanese and whoever, you know, needs dressing down and do it in a very public way, is that really such a bad idea for a Secretary General?
It is a perfectly plausible thing to say, but I think we need to keep in mind a couple of things. One, the fact that Kofi Annan, in fact, although he's not a screamer, has spoken from the rooftops. And in fact, during his first term, newspaper editorials routinely described him as the secular pope for raising questions with regard to the moral force of human rights and so on and so forth. He has done some of that. The second point is that screaming from the rooftop, as Andrew well knows, is a rapidly diminishing asset. You can do it once, you may be able to do it twice, and you're going to get slapped around by the member states. And the third time, you're either going to be out of a job or you won't be effective. So if you're going to do it, you have to calculate it very carefully, because you're not going to get to do it more than once or twice.
But if it's a stand of such important principle, yep, that in fact you scream from the rooftops and end up departing as a result of that, is there more force in that than continuing to work behind the scenes of the,
well,
you know what I mean?
That is, his style is to pick up the phone and to scream over the telephone,
yeah,
and to do as much of that as is humanly possible. In the Darfur case, it is slowly getting to a place where the UN can now say they are finally acting. But, you know, in the Darfur case, the Chinese are involved. What is Kofi Annan going to say to the Chinese government? They have oil interests in Sudan. They're not interested in budging. Kofi Annan has zero leverage over the Chinese government. So it's understandable that people are saying, get up and scream. But you also have to take into account the relative effectiveness of that step.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We want to know what you think. Just before we go to our callers, though, a word from Constanze Stelzenmüller. She is an international security editor for Die Zeit newspaper based in Hamburg. She's been listening and she's joining us on the line. Constanze, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Dick. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to hear from you, Constanze, because I wanted to know if this was an American conversation or if there are people in Europe and elsewhere in the world who are raising eyebrows about the future of Kofi Annan as Secretary General. What are you hearing?
Oh, not in the least. This is an issue that is very much on in public debate in Europe for different reasons. One, because Europeans traditionally and culturally are a little more UN-minded than the Americans. If you're not a superpower, but still pay quite a lot in UN dues. Germany, my country, is the third largest payer after America and the Japanese. Then you're interested in what the UN does well and what it does not does well and do well. And I think the general consensus here is that the UN is in dire need of reform, but it would be a huge mistake to throw it overboard. Something similar applies to Kofi Annan. He's done many, many important things, just as Mr. Ruggie has been saying, such as speaking out on human rights. But there is also a sense, and the Volcker report underlines that he's been at the very least a weak manager, and he's not out of the woods yet on that oil for food scandal, and that weakens him. And final point: the Europeans, or some of the Europeans, particularly my country, are interested in UN reform quite personally. The Germans, for example, want a permanent seat on the Security Council.
So can Kofi Annan see those reforms through? He says he's going to do it at a meeting in September, but the UN's been talking about reforming itself for the past 50 years. Is anything going to change?
Well, I think if you talk to diplomats at the UN and elsewhere, the mood for change and pragmatic reforms is now stronger than ever before. There is a feeling that after 50 years, something really does need to be done. And there is a lot of agreement on substantive issues, by the way, across the world, between America and Europe as well, such as on reforming the Human Rights Commission. That said, the Volcker report, the final Volcker report, is only due in June. And if it pins more responsibility on Kofi Annan, then the question would be whether he would be still strong enough to, if you will, captain that reform through until the meeting of the General Assembly in September. That would be very much in doubt.
Anyone being talked about as a replacement, Constanze, someone who has that kind of moral force?
I don't think we're there yet at all. There's no discussion of that yet. I think the assumption is that in America as well, that despite the flaws that Kofi Annan may have as a manager, there is, as Mr. Ruggie said before, there is some responsibility of the member states in all this. And he can only be as strong as the member states will let him. And on many issues, including Rwanda, including Darfur, one or several member states have prevented the UN from acting as forcefully as the Secretary Generals would have liked to have done. So I think at the moment the recognition is that Kofi Annan is still very necessary in his present job if seriously one wants UN reform. And the Americans, I think, are as interested in that as many other countries.
All right, time to hear what our listeners have to think. Constanze, thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure.
Sure.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is international security editor for Die Zeit newspaper based in Hamburg. To Charleston, South Carolina. Stephen's on the line. Hi, Stephen.
Hi there.
Tell me what you think.
I think basically one of the things that really stuns me as a humanitarian, as you're supposed to be, why wasn't some action taken on these genocides in Rwanda and Congo? Well, these things have been pushed under the carpet, I guess. But one of the few things that, how can all this oil for food program, that he's very arrogant when he mentioned to the newspaper the other day, are you resigning, Mr. Hill? And he said, not on your life, I'm not resigning. What an arrogant position to take for a man who's supposed to be such a humanitarian. We Americans created or wanted to keep the United Nations. We want to keep Europe together, a very socially unstable, there's socialist countries altogether trying to get work their way into capitalism, and they're not doing a very good job at it.
So are you saying he's the problem, Stephen?
I really do. I think that most honorable men in my life, and I go back to Porfumo when he was involved in the spy case in London, all those people, they resigned. They're honorable men. What's wrong with this man? That he, do we have a replacement? I mean, shouldn't somebody be thinking about this? He wasn't exonerated by Paul Volcker the other day. He made that statement himself. That's a little bit of a lie. He's very cunning, I see, you know?
All right. Let me, if I can, just hear from my guests on this. Andrew Thompson, just the question of the Oil for Food second interim report. I think we're talking about Kofi Annan said it exonerated him. One of the panel investigators said, no, not really an exoneration. We just don't have any reason to link the Secretary General to the corruption that appears to be there. Does that mean that questions over this continue to hang over him inside the UN?
I think it's early days on this. I always have a sense that he may be left in a limbo where he was exonerated, but for the reason that not enough evidence was found against him. So I'm not sure. You know, it is confusing when one of Mr. Volcker's deputies said that he wasn't exonerated and Mr. Annan says that he was. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think that it's gone away. John, I think it's almost given ammunition for people on both sides, those who think that he should stay and defend him and those who want him gone. It doesn't seem to be resolved.
John, is that sort of how you see it as well, that there's something there for both critics and supporters to work with?
Yeah, unfortunately, the document, well, it's a matter of fact, the document is written in a very, very legalese kind of fashion, very, very cautious wording, as a result of which you don't get a clear bottom line out of it, and it does feed into all sides' preferences about what it should say. That is one of the unfortunate things. But as I read it, it says basically two things about Kofi Annan. One, that there is no evidence to support the claim that he was engaged in any kind of conflict of interest directly. Secondly, it says that he should have been more aggressive after the fact in dealing with the appearance of a potential conflict of interest once the story got out that his son was working for the company that had won the bid.
Right, and this was 6 years ago. We're talking about 1999 when it first came up, right?
So you have no conflict of interest directly, but in managing subsequently the appearance, he should have been more aggressive in the kind of investigation he pushed for.
All right, let's go to Williamsburg, Virginia, and Andra is with us. Hi, Andra.
Good morning. I was just reading in the paper this morning about how the United States was a member of the 661 Committee monitoring Iraq's compliance with the sanctions, and as such had the power to veto sales of Iraqi oil and purchases of goods. But I'm reading that in March 2003, the Treasury Department provided assurances that the United States would not obstruct a plan by two companies to import millions of barrels of oil from Iraq in violation of the UN sanctions. Now, isn't there a little guilt to go around?
I mean, the funny thing about this, Andra, I was in Iraq at the time when the Oil for Food program was underway, and it wasn't a secret. I mean, you could see hundreds of oil tankers lined up waiting to cross the border into Turkey, moving illicit oil out of the country. Everybody knew it was going on. The fact that Saddam Hussein was finding ways of moving oil out, I don't think really is at the heart of this as much as it is Kofi Annan's own family role in this. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, and frankly, I think his son should have not been involved in it. But
well, frankly, I think as a father, you'd think he'd know what his son was up to. I mean, you know, as John's just talking about all the legalese in there, those of us who try to make sense of it in terms that we can understand, look at the fact that Junior was billing his company for time he spent with his father and thinking, that's, you know, that doesn't look very good, you know?
Yes, but illicit is illicit.
Right.
And let's spread some of this blame around about who's getting, you know, the cash from this stuff that's going on.
I want to turn to Andrew on this because we often think of this kind of situation, Andrew, in corporate terms. You know, you've got the CEO, he's in charge of the company, whatever happens in the mailroom or the accounting department or whatever ends up being something that the CEO needs to accept responsibility for. Is that a useful way of looking at Kofi Annan's responsibility here?
I think it is, Dick. I mean, you have a case in point with AIG at the moment where the company, a very respected Wall Street company, has separated itself from their long-term chairman over accounting irregularities and financial reserves. If AIG mismanages that, their stock goes down and people lose their jobs. But I think at the UN we need to be held to an even higher standard, because if we mismanage our programs, people in the vulnerable countries around the world where we're working actually suffer. And I think this gets lost in the Iraq oil for food debate, that however much money went missing, that money was supposed to go to buy food and medicine for Iraqi civilians who were suffering under our UN embargo. So I think when we talk about this, we should look at the effect on the people that we're supposed to serve and maybe ask their opinions. You know, what do Iraqis think about that money going missing? What do Rwandans think who survived the genocide? What do those people in Congo think that their women are being raped by our peacekeepers? I think we lose track sometimes in the debate of the people we're supposed to serve, and they're out there. They're not here in New York.
Dick, I just wanted to add that your caller put her finger on a really important issue. I don't want to engage in finger-pointing, but I do want to try to draw some lessons from the Iraq oil for food case. She's right that the 661 committee, so-called, it was basically a committee of the whole of the Security Council, oversaw and decided on each and every one of 36,000 contracts that were awarded under the Oil for Food program. The United States and Britain held up 5,000 of those contracts on potential dual-use technology grounds. That is to say, they wanted to make sure that no material that was relevant for weapons of mass destruction building could get into Iraq. That committee held up zero contracts, zero out of 36,000, on the grounds of pricing irregularities, even when they were alerted by the Secretariat that there were pricing irregularities. Now, that sent a very, very clear signal to the Secretariat, which is to say that Britain and the United States had different priorities. They were concerned with keeping the sanctions in place and keeping the arms embargo in place. And it was their position, obviously, that if there was some corruption going on, and they probably didn't know what the magnitude mm-hmm. of it was, and if that was the price to pay to keep the sanctions and the arms embargo in place, it was better than the alternative, which was going to war. Now, that's the kind of dilemma that we should be discussing.
But it comes back to exactly the same thing that Andrew is talking about. Who's in charge there? Is it the board of directors? Is it the member states sitting around that table? Or is it Kofi Annan as Secretary
General? On the contracts, it was clear. It was the Security Council 661 committee that approved all 36,000 contracts. 70 times, at least, it's been documented that the Secretariat warned them about pricing irregularities. The Security Council took no action.
So how do we see the role of the Secretary General? I mean, I think this is
he's not a CEO. I mean, I think that's a totally false analogy. It's okay. Not by accident that he's described in the charter as the chief administrative officer of the organization, not the chief executive officer.
So if there's something wrong with the organization, you're saying the wrong move is to get rid of the administrative officer at this point?
At this point, you certainly would not get a Secretary General elected by the current membership who would go up on the rooftop to shout. I think the United States in particular has had enough of an independent Secretary General, as Kofi Annan demonstrated he was when he criticized the United States in the context of Iraq, which is one of the reasons he's being so vehemently attacked in this country.
And Andrew, I mean, it's a good point. We have to go to a break shortly, but there's the suggestion that the U.S. actually likes to have a crippled U.N. Secretary General, much as they like to have Paul Wolfowitz running the World Bank.
I think that's a pretty cynical interpretation. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's listen to what our callers have to say about that. This hour, we're taking a look at the standing and the stature of Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN. He has two more years to serve in that position. He has promised some of the most wide-ranging reforms due for a conference to be discussed in a number of months' time. Does it make more sense to wait for that, see if the UN can be changed under his stewardship, or has he lost the kind of moral authority to bring that kind of change about? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. When Kofi Annan spoke recently about the future of the United Nations, he said the organization is in danger of becoming completely irrelevant unless it transforms itself. He's talking about the kinds of reforms that would in fact protect refugees on the ground, would in fact deal with questions of preemption, a kind of muscular UN, the likes of which we have not seen. So, should he be allowed to stick around and see if he can put this in place, or has he lost the kind of standing that would allow him to do that? We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to Chesapeake, Virginia for our next call. Samuel's on the line. Hi, Samuel.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, I have three comments. The first one has to do with the relationship between Mr. Annan and his son. Mr. Annan's son actually lives in Nigeria, between Nigeria and Ghana, and he lives with his Mr. Annan's first wife. So I'm trying to understand how such a relationship can sort of like, he can monitor his son's relationship in terms of his employment and all that. Secondly, the Swiss company that hired him basically paid him to actually not to have any conflict of interest with other companies that were competing for the same, so that he wouldn't basically go work for another company that might have interest within the Oil for Food program. Second comment, there are so many competing interests within the UN system, that especially among nations, that there are actually, like the previous caller said, there are nations that actually monitor the efficiency of the corruption that was taking place. Third, if this had, basically we are actually seeing, I would basically compare Ms. Annan to our Vice President, Mr. Cheney. Mr. Cheney used to be the CEO of Halliburton, and Halliburton, as we all know, has had some sort of corrupt relations with the...
So are you saying he should go, or are you saying he should stay, Samuel? Be quick.
I'm saying he should stay, because if Halliburton can have such a relationship with Vice President Dick Cheney, and nobody can actually call for investigation, why should Mr. Annan, who...
I don't know if the Cheney example is a real vote of confidence in Kofi Annan. Andrew Thompson, I don't want to go back onto the corporate example, because I think we kind of have looked at that. I'm wondering if we can nudge this ahead to some sense of what would happen if he were to leave, and how the UN would go ahead. Where would that kind of leadership come from?
I'm not sure at all. It would depend on who replaced him. You know, I'm completely loyal to the UN, and even if they'd succeeded in throwing me out, which they haven't, I'd still remain loyal. And
because
I'll support anyone who restores our prestige and our credibility. So if he can do that, he has my full support. But I think the jury's still out on it. One positive thing that's come out of this, of my own saga, is Mr. Annan's turnaround on my case in terms of whistleblowing. And now at the UN, there's a kind of Official Secrets Act where staff can't speak out, like a gag order. And my legal victory recently has made an exception to that. And it's actually pushed the UN, and I admire them for this, to start looking at a whistleblower protection policy for staff. And they're going to come out with that next week. So I think that's positive. I think that...
You think it could become a better organization if people like you had the latitude to say, this is wrong, my boss is stealing, or whatever needs to be said?
I think that's right. There are no checks and balances on senior UN officials. They don't go through any kind of confirmation hearings. When they fail, or when they mismanage, or when they engage in fraudulent activities, often they just get moved on. And I think that one thing that will help the health of the organization is if people can speak out and not fear risk losing their jobs like I did. So I'm looking forward to seeing what will come up next week in that whistleblower policy.
I mean, we have, John Ruggie, been through a list of things that have bedeviled the UN for the past 8 years that Kofi Annan's been Secretary General, and even before that. If we look back over the same period of time, can we say that he's shown that he can make the kinds of changes that Andrew's looking forward to, and that could, in fact, lead to genuine reform?
Dick, Kofi Annan had a fabulous first term. His first 5 years in office were universally regarded as successful, and he was known as a reformer. The first initiative he undertook when he came in was a set of internal management reforms. They didn't go far enough. But I was involved in that at the time. We drew up a list after 6 months of all the measures that were under the control of the Secretary General versus those that required the approval of member states.
Right.
After 6 months, we had checked off all of the boxes that were under the control of the Secretary General, none that required the endorsement or action by the General Assembly had yet been adopted. So we got to keep in mind all the time that this is a divided house. It is a secretariat on the one hand and a set of governments making decisions on the other.
Quick question, though. You were there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's been there for 42 years. He started in 1962 in a UN position outside New York. One of the most stinging criticisms of him is that he has become too much a creature of the organization, too comfortable within a bureaucracy that needs, a little bit of a shakeup. Is that reasonable?
Well, I think if the events of the last year haven't sent a wake-up call, then we really are in trouble. But I think Andrew is right. They are putting in place a whistleblower protection. They're developing a Freedom of Information Act, the first time ever in the United Nations. And, of course, transparency and accountability are the biggest challenges. Those are being improved as well. Whether that goes far enough or not remains to be seen.
All right. Back to our callers to Columbia, South Carolina. Roberta is on the line. Hi, Roberta.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. What do you think?
Well, I have admired Kofi Annan's leadership over the years with the Oil for Food program. It's so difficult to know where the truth lies with this.
True enough.
It seems to me that the United States, especially under Republican leadership, has tried to thwart and diminish the role of the UN. During the Clinton administration, I remember that the Congress refused to pay the UN dues, and we have tried to dominate the body. And at some point, and this may sound a little too futuristic, we need a world body that protects the rights of the citizens of the world. We need the world court. We need citizenship. National states seem to be dissolving more and more today. And the rights through the World Bank and through the IMF of corporations are protected, but we don't have protections in place for small countries that are being exploited and for citizens.
Set aside the small countries for a moment, though, Roberta. What you're talking about is anathema to people inside the White House right now, the idea that there be some kind of global organization which would have any sway over the United States is something that they have actively resisted. The International Criminal Court, anything that smacks of that.
Absolutely, and I'm perfectly aware of that, but that does not change the fact that that's what we need, that the world citizenship, we need to be protected. We need to have some rights. The rights of corporations have gone way out in front of those of the citizens of the world, and there needs to be a world body. It's clear to me that the United States is not going to do anything to try to protect either its citizens or anyone else's citizens.
I'm going to go to Andrew on just the role of the United States in this organization, because it is it's supposed to pay the largest amount of dues. In fact, did pay up its dues recently, and the U.S. fancies, and not unreasonably, that it has then considerable say in what the direction of the UN ought to be. How does that go down in New York, Andrew?
I think it goes back to what I was saying before, that there's a feeling that powerful member states pick and choose. So when there's something that they think the UN can be useful for, they push that, and when they don't agree on the direction that the UN's taking, they criticize it. The mirror of that is what I mentioned before as well. The UN, when something goes well, takes credit. Mr. Annan's Nobel Peace Prize is a case in point. And when it goes badly, often tries to shift the blame. I can imagine that the US administration wants more of a say. They do pay, I think, a quarter of the budget. But I don't think they can pick and choose what they want. Certainly, that will get resisted at the UN, and I think you see that over Iraq.
I'm wondering, John, in your view, because you've watched the clash between Kofi Annan and President Bush over Iraq from Boston, not from inside the headquarters, and how that has changed the UN. In many ways, the UN became an agent for those countries that weren't happy with the U.S., and in the long run, that has its destructive side as well.
Well, there's an African proverb that when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled on, and the U.N. Secretariat part of the house was trampled on badly during the lead-up to and the Iraq War itself, because it was quite clear that the United States didn't care much whether the Council agreed or not. They were determined to go to war. And France and Germany were determined to try to use the United Nations to try to restrain the United States. And that was an absolute no-win situation for the UN institution that got caught in between, and it was not at all a happy time for them. But
so
I think
has the UN been diminished by that? Is that what you're saying?
I think the UN was diminished in the eyes of many members of the American public who felt betrayed that the UN wouldn't jump to the assistance of the United States at a time of what they thought was a time of need. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, 80% of the rest of the world didn't agree with the Bush administration, and that was reflected at the United Nations.
And Andrew, if I take the thrust of what I'm hearing you're saying, it's places like Darfur where the UN rehabilitates itself, not in Baghdad, not in clashing with the major powers, but it's not doing that.
That's right, and it would be an interesting question for Mr. Annan, you know, to ask him, what did you learn during those failures in Rwanda and at Srebrenica in Bosnia that you're doing differently on Darfur now? And I think, I don't know the answer to that, but I think that you have to judge the UN on what it achieves, not what it preaches. So often we say one thing and we achieve another, and that contributes to our credibility being diminished. But you really have to judge the organization by its work on the front lines. And I think that many parts of the UN work really well. Look at the High Commissioner for Refugees. Look at the response to the tsunami. Look at the World Health Organization dealing with the SARS epidemic. Look at, for example, the two war crimes tribunals, the one for Bosnia or former Yugoslavia and the one for Rwanda, putting genocidal killers on trial. Well, those parts of it work magnificently.
And why aren't those gold stars on Kofi Annan's chest at the same time?
It's a good question. I think there's just been a series of scandals on his watch, and it's the question, how much is he accountable for that, right, even if he's not found guilty of criminal activities? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how much longer it can go on, though, with one scandal after another. Yeah. The buck has to stop somewhere, I think.
Let's go back to our callers, to Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin's on the line. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Tell me what you think.
I'm listening to kind of the liberal presentation here that we need a world body to kind of set moral standards for the world, and I'm going to give you the conservative viewpoint here. Kofi Annan, if he had speaking out against our invasion of Iraq, was protecting his little back pocket oil scheme, just like France and Britain in being against our invasion of Iraq.
Can I ask you, Martin, what we do with the UN? So where do we go from here? What do you think?
What do we do with the UN?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of as a world body, it's the best it seems to be the best hope from the humanistic standpoint. But if we're going to exclude religion and morality, which is an accountability to God as opposed to this world government which depends on power, then we can have a just world. But if we're going to say that religion is irrelevant and the moral law and the Ten Commandments are irrelevant, then we're all lost. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about man's kingdom versus God's kingdom, and where is absolute values and morality?
I want to use the last few minutes of the program, if I can, though, to ask both John and Andrew to give me their sense of that answer to that question. How dramatically can the UN transform itself? As long as it remains an organization, John, that has to take into account the ambassador, with the views of the ambassador from, Colombia and Paraguay and Pakistan at the same time as it has to listen to the Canadians and the Danes. And I mean, isn't it always going to be a clumsy, slow, and frustrating place?
Of course it is, Dick. And it isn't only different opinions at the national level. There are real structural issues that aren't going to change anytime soon. We were talking before about Congo and the peacekeepers and sexual exploitation. Some of your listeners may not know that the United Nations does not have an army. When the Security Council decides to put a peacekeeping mission somewhere, the Secretary General has to get on the telephone and start calling around saying, do you have any spare soldiers you can send to a peacekeeping mission? Then when they get sent there, the UN is not allowed to discipline the soldiers of the countries that provide the soldiers. Only the countries can discipline them. Those are the rules of the game.
The conundrum is they're not Moroccans there. They're UN peacekeepers. They wear a blue helmet.
They are seen as UN peacekeepers, but the fact is they remain under the effective command and control of Morocco or whatever other country it is, and can only be disciplined by them. So the improvements in terms of putting out circulars and having seminars and workshops...
Are you saying the UN needs an army, then?
No, what I'm saying is people need to understand that the current system imposes severe limits on what the institution of the UN can actually do to improve some of the situations that we've been addressing here.
Is there a fix to that, Andrew, from your perspective? You spend a lot of time in the field.
I look ahead and I wonder, you know, after, I mean, not in 2 years, but in 10 years, whether young people who go out like we did on the front lines will see the same things that we saw, the very best of the UN, for example, in Cambodia, and then just the horrors of non-action in the face of genocide. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I think if it changes, it's going to change really slowly. But I think what helps is ripping away this code of secrecy and culture of impunity, which seems to be starting to happen now. Senior people are getting nailed for their actions. I think it's going to be slow.
It's always going to be a place where diplomats live, though, and that's always going to make it that much harder to have that kind of openness, isn't it, Andrew?
I agree with John that screaming from the rooftops for a secretary general has a law of diminishing returns, but I think there are times that you can do it, and I think that's what people expect. We don't have an army. We're not well-funded. But I think that the secretary general as a moral role can actually make a huge difference in ringing the alarm.
Andrew, thanks for being with us on the program. It's nice to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Thompson, senior medical officer for the UN Medical Service at UN headquarters in New York. John Ruggie, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
John is professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and former assistant secretary general under Kofi Annan. Earlier in the program, we talked with Constance Dauschen-Müller. She is a reporter for Die Zeit newspaper in Hamburg, Germany. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Mary Stack, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.